Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ann Miller, and as the Director of New Hampshire Peace Action, I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's program with Ray McGovern. I'd like to start, though, by saying thank you to Rosanna Patain and the York Coalition for helping to organize this event. And also just one more note, just so folks know, there are absentee ballots and voter registration cards up here. Please help yourself on your way out. Okay. The title of this afternoon's presentation is Are We Safer? An ex-CIA analyst's perspective on intelligence and the war in Iraq. Ray McGovern has a long and distinguished history with the U.S. intelligence community. His career with the CIA spans 27 years, 9 CIA directors, and the presidencies of John F. Kennedy through George H.W. Bush. During his tenure, Ray's responsibilities included chairing various national intelligence estimates and preparing the presidential daily brief. During the mid-1980s, Ray was one of the senior analysts conducting early morning briefings one-on-one with the vice president, the secretaries of state and defense, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the assistant to the president for national security affairs. In early 2003, January, as the call for war grew louder, a group of intelligence community veterans, including Ray, founded the organization Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. Concerned about the threat to the intelligence community's search for unbiased truth, VIPS spoke out against the administration's use of intelligence reports to make its case for preemptive action in Iraq. VIPS' first paper was a same-day critique of Secretary of State Colin Powell's address to the UN on February 5, 2003. That paper has withstood the test of time well. In addition to co-authoring some of VIPS memoranda, Ray has published some 25 op-eds over the past year on intelligence-related issues in both the U.S. and Europe. They have appeared in the Boston Globe, the Christian Science Monitor, the Miami Herald, and the International Herald Tribune. Ray recently appeared in Robert Greenwald's documentary, Uncovered, The Whole Truth About the War in Iraq, and on the Charlie Rose Show, where he debated former CIA Director James Woolsey on the current state of intelligence and the CIA. His most recent op-ed has been submitted around several New Hampshire papers and can be found at truthout.org. Ray will be speaking for just about 30 minutes, and then we'll take the next 30 minutes to answer any questions that you may have about his presentation. If you enjoy this afternoon's program, I encourage you to come speak with me more about what Peace Action does and the various programs that we put on. I also welcome you to take a brochure about what New Hampshire Peace Action is doing around the state of New Hampshire. I would just close by asking that you silence your cell phones, if you have not done so already, for the duration of the lecture. So on that note, I'd like to introduce Mr. Ray McGovern.
Thank you. I'm really impressed. It's a beautiful day out there, and y'all come in here to listen to the likes of me. That says something for your interest, or maybe for hopefully not for your foolishness here. I'll try to honor the compliment. I was thinking, why do I feel a sort of affinity with York? And I realized I'm a Yorker. I'm a returned New Yorker. I grew up in the Bronx, but I spent a lot of time, I worked during summers out on Long Island, where people had money and they were willing to share that money with me if I carried their golf bags. And the parts of Long Island where I worked look exactly like York, and so I feel very much at home here. I would also say that I've been outspoken in what I've been saying over the last several months, because I think it's a critical time in our history, and I think that one needs to be guided by some of our great leaders in the past. Now, this area just smells of history, and I think of, you know, think of Thoreau and Emerson, and I like to start out by quoting a fellow from farther down south, but nonetheless a patriot, and his name is Tom Paine. He wrote The Rights of Man in 1791, and this is what he said. The slavery of fear has made men afraid to think. But such is the irresistible nature of truth that all it asks, all it wants, is the liberty of appearing. Now, my friends and I, and veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, have been very disappointed over the last few years at how little of the truth has been made available to the American people, and how hard it is for Americans to make an enlightened decision, enlightened choices, with the amount of information that they have available through what we used to call the mainstream media. And maybe I could just say right now that having watched the political scene in this country very closely for 42 years, the biggest sea change that I have observed, and the most significant one, is that, in my view, we no longer have, in a real sense, a free press. Our press is very much managed, it's very much domesticated, and I'm talking mostly about TV, cable channels, and even some of our newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, who now acknowledge they became cheerleaders for a war that had dubious purpose and that has us in a quagmire right now. So we're trying to spread a little truth around. Now, nobody pretends, well, some people pretend to have a corner on the truth. We don't. We come out of a very bright, vibrant sort of university-type analytical milieu where it's foolish to prove to think that you have the corner on the truth. But by dialogue and by experience and by doing this kind of analysis in my professional life was 27 years with the CIA, you get a certain familiarity with the sources, you get a certain discipline where you can analyze the media. And another thing I should say right up front is that although Americans don't realize this, the classified part of the evidence you need to analyze a certain country or issue usually amounts to only between 5% and 20% of the information at hand. In other words, 80% and more is usually available in open media. And if you are familiar with analyzing open media, if you keep track of it over a period of time, it's a no-brainer. It's, you know, what's the difference about what's being said today and what they said 2 weeks ago and that kind of thing. And you get very, very, very able and very confident about making decisions. In the Bronx, we would say, give me a for instance. So I'll give you a for instance. We all know about weapons of mass destruction. Okay, what none of us knew until an Australian documentary maker put it in his film is that in 2001, specifically on February 24th, Colin Powell got up at a press conference and said, let me quote this so that I don't paraphrase it, and you'll realize it is a quote. Quote, Saddam Hussein has not developed any significant capacity with respect to weapons of mass destruction. He is unable to project conventional power against his neighbors. End quote. February 24, 2001. July 29, 2001. Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor. Quote, we're able to keep Saddam Hussein's arms from him. His military forces have not been rebuilt, end quote. Okay, now, number one, why is it that it took a Australian journalist to dig that fact out 2 years after these things were said? Where was the U.S. press? Where were the people who were covering this weapons of mass destruction issue? I mean, I would happen to be in that documentary that the Australian journalist did, and so I emailed him and said, where did you get that stuff? Because I wasn't aware of it either. I hadn't done my homework either to that extent. And he said, Ray, I'm a responsible journalist. What I did was ask for tapes of everything that Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell had said for 2 years before I was doing the documentary. I took all those tapes and I started to go into this booth to listen, and my friends said they feared for my sanity, you know, but I spent 2 days listening to all these things, and I found them, and so I put them in the documentary. Now, I asked myself, I'm a journalist for the Washington Post, and I want to write about weapons of mass destruction and what Colin Powell and old Condoleezza Rice were saying in 2002, okay? We're not talking about, you know, a decade ago. We're talking about a year before. Am I not going to do a LexisNexis search? I mean, I don't even have to go into a booth. All I have to do is take these things in and find out what they said before. Well, either no one did that, which I find really hard to believe, or they did it and their editor edited it out. So none of us knew that they said these things. And that includes people like me who are watching this thing frightfully closely. So that's really what we're up against, and what I want to do is just kind of give some sort of flavor for what we used to do in the CIA and why I am and my friends are so, I'll skip the adjective and you'll find out later about what has happened. It's necessary really to remind people why the CIA was established. Because invariably when I come into a town like this, somebody says to me, you don't look like a CIA guy, you know? And I never know whether to be crestfallen or happy about that. You know, I still haven't figured that out. But it betrays a lack of understanding. If you get your concept of the CIA from the movies or from the TV, that ain't it, folks. The CIA was set up in 1947 by the National Security Act for two main purposes. One, to have one central place, okay, one central place where somebody like me would be accountable. It's a word we don't use much in Washington anymore, accountable. But someone would be accountable, responsible for all the pieces of information on a given country or subject. Okay, mine was Soviet foreign policy way back in the 60s and 70s. And that person would have access to all this stuff. So it wouldn't be like Pearl Harbor where some people had this and some people had that. One person would have. That's what we call a central intelligence agency, okay? And second, everyone perceived the need to have one place in town that had no policy agenda. You know? One place in town where the president could go and say, look, I would like you to tell me what you really think. Now you have the equivalent of two universities out there, okay? Your expertise. You're a specialist, know a lot about these things. I want to know what you really think. I don't care what the State Department is saying. I don't care what the Pentagon is saying. I want to know what you really think because I have a tough decision to make and I need an honest answer. Now, can you imagine what an asset that is for a president to be able to come and to have a trusted person? The president's thinking, this guy is not going to tell me what he thinks I want to hear. This guy's going to tell me like it is. He's not afraid. He's not afraid of being fired. He knows I can fire him. But he's been around. He's made his own mark. He doesn't need me. But he's going to tell me what I think, okay? What he thinks. Now, that's what gave us sort of joie de vivre, gave us kind of a real feeling of being special. We were really the only place in town that could do this. And we had career protection for doing that. In other words, the director would send me down to do battle with Henry Kissinger, if you can believe it. Here, you know, middle-level bureaucrat like me, you go down, he says to me as I leave, you go down and don't sell my stock short, Ray. But, yes, sir. And I go down there and I get beat about the mouth and head, figuratively speaking, of course, and come back and the director says, how'd you do? I said, I'd get to first base. Kissinger won't listen to me. And he said, you did a good job. I'm proud of you. Our job is to tell the truth. If they don't like it, you know, that's not our problem. If they won't be guided by it, that's not our problem. The rest of that story is not so happy. This director, William Colby, was fired just a few weeks later, but it wasn't because of what McGovern said. It was because of all the McGoverns that he had sent down there telling the truth and telling Kissinger and Nixon things they didn't particularly want to hear. So I think it's really important to set that stage and then to kind of maybe you get a feel for how we intelligence professionals feel when we see the process corrupted. And institutional corruption of the CIA began under William Casey, who was the head of the CIA under Ronald Reagan. He saw a Soviet under every rock, and he knew that the Soviet Union could never change, that Gorbachev was just he was a clever commie, more clever than the others, but he was still a commie in the communist system. And that's why CIA got it wrong on the Soviet Union. Small thing like the fall of the Soviet Union. That's why they missed that. And that's why people got promoted who were more interested in advancing their career and could sniff the winds coming from the White House or the seventh floor of the CIA and trim their analytical sails accordingly, okay? And those are the folks that got moved up. And so here, 24 years later, when George Tenet comes back from the White House and says to his assembled senior analysts, we have to do an estimate on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, and it's got to come out the same way Vice President Cheney put it in his recent speech, namely, they're seeking nuclear weapons, they have chemical and biological weapons, and UN inspections aren't worth a damn. Now, if a director in my day came back and said that to us, we would say, that's really good. You're not serious. I mean, you can't be serious. I mean, we don't do that. You know, we look at the stuff and we tell it like it is. You're serious? There would have been mass revolt. There would have been a mass revolt. There was a deterrent in the ethic, the ethos that we had, and it was as thick as could be. And so to see what happened in September of exactly 2 years ago, 2002, where the new senior managers are assembled and Tenet says exactly that. So then they say, yes, sir, how soon do you need it? And served up to the President of the United States is the worst intelligence estimate on record. Got it wrong, demonstrably wrong, we know now, on all major points but one, okay? Now, having said all that, you know, and having said, hey guys, the intelligence was really lousy, partly because of ineptitude, but mostly because of politicization, I have to add one important thing, and that is, and please listen, that intelligence had nothing to do with the president's decision to make war in Iraq. That decision to make war in Iraq came many months before any intelligence was adduced ex post facto to justify it. I mean, if you go back to the very first National Security Council meeting on January 30th, 2001, and we know this from Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of the Treasury, who was there and has written about it, the sole subject, well, there are two subjects really, but the most important subject was Saddam Hussein. How are we going to get him? Not if we're going to get him, whether we need to get him, but how are we going to get him? Show me the way. And the second one was the Israel-Palestinian dispute. We're just going to, we know who our friends are, we're going to support Israel 100%, and no more of this honest broker stuff that's just a waste of time, the results of which we see today. So, and there are a whole thing, a whole scheme of, you know, we analysts do chronologies. Well, I have about 10 things that show that the decision for war was made well before there was any estimate. Why was there no estimate? Because the head of the CIA was keeping his head way down. Had he asked for an honest estimate, there's a very good chance that his analysts would have said, you know, we don't really know. The evidence is so lousy that we're not really sure whether he has any weapons of mass destruction at all. And that was clearly not what the White House wanted to hear. And so there was no estimate. Is that a gross abnegation of duty? Of course it is. The head of the CIA is the president's chief intelligence advisor. Whether he liked it or not, he should have had an estimate done. But he didn't. Until when? Until exactly 2 years ago, well, 2 years and 1 month ago, when they all came back from vacation. And they said, okay, we're going to have this war. Now, what do we do now? We want to have it before next summer. It gets hot in Iraq in the summer. We're going to win quickly. And somebody said, well, there's this constitution thing. What do you mean, constitution thing? Well, The Constitution says that the elected representatives of the people in the Congress has the sole authority to make war. So I guess we have to do what your daddy did, and I guess we need to persuade Congress that, you know, there's a big threat there. How are we going to do that? Well, there were not an easy way to do that, because the CIA had looked at evidence that Iraq was involved in 9/11, or that Iraq had operational ties with al-Qaeda, and there was no evidence. So they couldn't use that argument with Congress, because what happens if you use an argument like that, honest analysts, to the degree they have access to Congress, they come back under and undercut you. Couldn't use the argument that there were chemical and biological weapons, because the defense intelligence analysts had just written a memo saying there was no solid evidence that they were there either. And so they were left to rely on this report. Many of you will remember this. This was the report that Iraq was seeking uranium in the African country of Niger. Do you remember that report? Okay. Now, when that report came in, the vice president's ears lit up, and he said, gosh, that's an interesting report. Find out more about it. And some of you know the story about Ambassador Wilson who went down there and all that stuff. Well, the CIA analysts, to their credit, said, you know, this report is false on its face. Why? Well, because the African country of Niger doesn't control the uranium that's mined in Niger. It's controlled by an international consortium, and of all people, the French lead that international consortium. And so there's no way that any of that uranium could be given or sold to Iraq without all these people knowing about it, and it would have to be accounted for. Besides that, Iraq already has this yellowcake uranium. It's not a question of getting it, it's a question of purifying it more for nuclear weapons development. They had tons of it in Iraq already. So the analyst is looking at this and he says, well, you know, this one's easy. I can just dismiss this and tell the vice president, everybody else, that, you know, it doesn't make any sense. So you throw it in a circular file, okay? A couple months later, we found out that the report was based on a forgery, okay? So this reminds me of, some of you are old enough to remember The King and I and Yul Brynner's role in that, and when he stands up and he says, so it's a false lie. Well, that's what we had here, you know, something false on its face and based on forgery. Now, I'm not happy to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that your representatives and your senators were deceived by that false lie into fearing that a mushroom cloud could descend on Washington, New York, or York, and that would be, in the president's words, the first sign that Saddam Hussein had developed a nuclear weapon. That report was briefed to your congressman and mine and your senators and mine, and don't take my word for it. Read the letters, the stinging letters, such as Henry Waxman of California wrote to the president before the war, saying, Mr. President, I voted for this war, and now your people are admitting that it was based on your argument was based on a forgery? Now, how can that be? You know? He hasn't got a satisfactory answer from the president. So, now, I guess I'd just say that I was searching for a word before to explain how we feel. We veteran intelligence folks who were different to it, were accustomed to a different ethos. Outrage doesn't do it, you know, it's not strong enough. And outrage not only at the way our, now we spent 27 years laboring in the fields and feeling proud of serving up to policymakers as close as you can come to the truth. It really hurts when you see that kind of frittered away, you see that prostituted. Maybe that's the appropriate word. But as an American, my God, you know, I'm a conservative. I lost a lot of liberal friends because I thought that Bill Clinton should not only be impeached, but he should be convicted. Why? Because he lied under oath. That's a high crime and misdemeanor. And all my liberal friends, ah, Ray, don't you know what the Republicans are trying to do him? Gee, I know what the Republicans are trying to do him, but he lied under... So I have this kind of weird attachment to the Constitution. And when I see one branch of government deliberately usurping the prerogatives of another branch of government, in this case, the executive taking the powers away from the Congress, by tricking them, by giving them this mushroom cloud stuff. Do you remember the mushroom cloud?
Yes, I do.
Do you remember the 7th of October? So just 2 years and 1 week from now, the president said the first sign could be a mushroom cloud. On the 8th of October, Condoleezza Rice, first sign could be a mushroom cloud. 9th of October, Victoria Clark from the Pentagon, first sign should be a mushroom cloud. The 10th and 11th of October, Congress votes to give the president carte blanche for war. I had never seen so cynical. I've seen a lot of stuff in Washington, including the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which was somewhat akin to this, but I've never seen such a cynical, protracted campaign to use intelligence to deceive our elected representatives. And that bothers me greatly. And I think that's a constitutional crisis that doesn't seem to bother the press, but I think it's very serious indeed. And I like to think you folks up here in New England set great store by the Constitution. Now, are we safer? There isn't any reputable analyst or policymaker I know that says we're safer. As most of you know, it's well established that Iraq had no operational ties with Al-Qaeda then. Estimates of how many Al-Qaeda are in Iraq now vary, but they're in the thousands, okay? What the United States and Britain have done is alienate... Well, you know, there are a billion Muslim people in the world. A billion. That's a lot. Seems like a lot, anyway. All the Arab countries, and a lot of the Muslims, have a steady diet of watching Al Jazeera or some of the other Arab TV stations. What do they see? They see Abu Ghraib. They see other stuff, targeting so-called safe houses in Fallujah. You know, what's a safe house? Well, they're thinking that maybe terrorists live in these safe houses, but just as often women and children live in those safe houses. Terrorists, insurgents, that's what we're told are there, you know. That's what we were told in Vietnam. We're fighting terrorists and we're fighting insurgents. He's not an insurgent. He's a resistance. The situation is much more comparable to France under Nazi occupation. These people are trying to throw out the invader. They resent it, you know? And they don't like the Quislings, the Vichy. They don't like the collaborators that have been put in by the invader. So that's sort of an aside. So what am I saying? I'm saying that the action in Iraq has lengthened the recruiting stations for Osama bin Laden by a factor of about 10. And this is going to come back to haunt us for a very long time, my friends, a very long time. So we can expect that kind of terrorism to impact on us right here in these states, but because of what we've done in Iraq. Now let me take a slightly different tack and say that there's an equal threat, in my view, to our national security. It has to do with what I'd call internal terrorism, threats to our civil liberties. Now, I like to think you guys up here feel a little strongly about civil liberties, and so I'm going to read you a transcript from a heated discussion between Representative Kucinich and Bob Kerry, not John Kerry, but Bob Kerry, the former senator from Nebraska. I don't really remember him all that well, but I had the idea he was a fairly moderate Democrat and somebody who wasn't going to drink the Kool-Aid, as we put it. Somebody would keep a kind of a balanced view of things. And what I'd like to do is just read you part of a transcript. I happened to be listening to the radio. I was driving around doing errands, and I was listening to the hearings on intelligence restructuring, you know. And here's this exchange between Kucinich and Kerry, Bob Kerry. Kucinich. I'm pleased that the 9/11 Commission identified civil liberties as an area of major concern. And those of us that were involved in the debates over the Patriot Act have worked to pass amendments that would be guided by the spirit of Ben Franklin, who said, quote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." Kerry, I have to tell you that if Ben Franklin were around today and he'd been on the 9/11 commission like me and had to come to terms with Ramzi Youssef and Osama bin Laden and other guys who sit around and talk about killing hundreds of thousands of Americans, I think that Ben Franklin would say, well, wait a minute, we can't just sit around here and worry about violating Osama bin Laden or Ramzi Youssef's civil liberties. Well, that's not what Kucinich is talking about. He's talking about violating our civil liberties, right? Kucinich. You haven't answered my question about civil liberties. Kerry, in 1999 and 1988, with all due respect, Kucinich, please answer my question about... Kerry, you say all due respect, but you keep interrupting me. Now, listen, the enemy has no concerns for civil liberties. The enemy has no concern for the Geneva Convention. So we've got to come at a hard-headed attitude here, and we're not going to get this thing balanced right if we don't do that. Kucinich, please tell me, how are you going to protect civil liberties? I don't think you can protect civil liberties absolutely, says Kerry. That's scary. I'm getting them now at the back of my neck. I don't know if you are. And when you see the kinds of stuff that's been going on, you know, how many of the celebrated arrests of terrorists by Ashcroft's folks, how many of them that were brought to trial were sustained?
Zero.
How many people have been held without bail, some in solitary confinement for 2-3 years without being brought to trial, without even access to a lawyer? American citizens. God, you know, I think about Paul in the scriptures. He says, I'm a Roman citizen. That used to mean something. I mean, to be a citizen of a major country. I'm an American citizen. Well, sit in the brig down there in Norfolk, and maybe your case will come up in a couple of years. So I don't think we're any safer. I think we're in jeopardy here, in jeopardy of losing something very sacred. When John Ashcroft gets up, without the benefit of the head of the CIA, without the presence of the head of the Homeland Security Department, and he says, I'm here to warn the American people that there's almost inevitably going to be a terrorist attack before the election, before November 2nd. Did I tell you? Before the election. And the reason I know that is because an Al-Qaeda spokesman has said that Al-Qaeda is now 90% ready to hit us, and they're going to hit us hard. Now, I'm asking myself, whoa, why is it that the CIA guy there and the Homeland Security guy aren't there? Only Mueller is there from the FBI, and he's dutifully bowing like this. So I pursued it further, and do you know who the Al-Qaeda spokesman was? It was the Abu Hafs al-Masri Brigades. Anybody know about those? Nobody. Okay. Well, I'm not surprised. The intelligence people tell me that the Abu Hafs al-Masri Brigades consist of one man with a fax machine who has claimed credit for everything from brownouts in the West, blackouts around London, and the Madrid bombings. Okay. Nobody takes them seriously. It's sort of a big joke at the CIA. Now, this is not funny, guys. Why is John Ashcroft adducing the prospect of a terrorist event before the elections, you got it right, before the elections, on that kind of evidence? Well, that scares me too. And I am genuinely worried, and maybe some of you have read some of my stuff on this, that if at this time next month John Kerry's numbers come up and George Bush's go down, that this group will resort to extra legal measures to do what's necessary for 4 more years, whether it's postponing the election or whatever. Now, some of you would say, well, all right, McGovern, now you've gone off the deep end. And they've, you know, said that last year when I said I didn't think there were any weapons of mass destruction. But let me add one little dot here. You know, we talk about it down in Washington, where all is connecting dots now. You know, there's one big dot that you probably may not be aware of, but I think needs to be accorded a lot of importance. Please hear me out on this. The President of the United States is arguably a war criminal under U.S. law. Now, we know that our government doesn't pay much attention to international law anymore, but there's a U.S. Code 18-2442, which says, it's 1996, recent law, which says that the United States and its leaders will faithfully implement all the provisions of the Geneva Conventions on Prisoners of War. Now, why do I say all this? I say that because the President wanted to exempt people like terrorists or, you know, Al-Qaeda or Taliban. And so they said, well, I don't know if you could do that. And finally, he was served up a memorandum dated January 25, 2002, which said, it was from Alberto Gonzalez, his White House counsel. And it said, yes, indeed, Mr. President, the Geneva Conventions are very precise as to what can be allowed. They don't really provide for any exemptions of, you know, taking people out of the protections of the Geneva Conventions. And there is this U.S. law which carries extreme penalties, including death. And the Geneva Conventions make it very clear that those who would be held accountable are the supreme authorities of these countries, not just, you know, the five bad apple soldiers. Attorney General Ashcroft assures me that he's had his lawyers look into this, and you can go ahead and exempt the Taliban, and there's a reasonable basis in law, quote unquote, that you can escape prosecution if at some time in the future some mean-spirited prosecutor were appointed and decided to press charges. Now, some of you know that 8 former presidents of the U.S. Bar Association, American Bar Association, including another, John Sessions, who headed up the FBI, have come out appealing for those lawyers in the Justice Department that try to make it possible to do torture and that kind of stuff, that they should be disbarred, that they should be censured. If we concede that the president doesn't read a lot, and maybe didn't read the 25th January memo, you can be sure he knows about it now because it's been in Time magazine. That's how I read it, you know, read it on the web. Now, you're President Bush, and you go in bed at night, and you're thinking, 4 more years, I sure hope I get 4 more years. And then you're thinking, what about that Gonzalez memo? There's a reasonable basis in law that I could escape prosecution. I'm not going to feel real good about that, you know? I'm really not going to feel real good about that. And neither is Ashcroft, and neither is Cheney, and neither is Rumsfeld. And we're talking, again, U.S. law. And so that's a big dot for me. And I put that dot over here with Ashcroft on the 26th of May, talking about the terrorist event before the election. And what I'm suggesting to you folks is this. There are some people that tell me that there's a line that the Bush administration won't cross, you know. I've been looking for that line for 3.5 years now. I've already explained to you what happened to the Constitution in September of 2 years ago. If, as I say, things look pretty tenuous for the president this time next month, I would not rule out some sort of terrorist threat, real or contrived, terrorist plans to attack our polling booths. And well, how will the Americans react? Now, I think I know how you guys would react. But, you know, after Ashcroft said his thing, Tom Ridge, the head of Homeland Security, he asked the Justice Department for an opinion on how he'd go about postponing the elections, you know.
He did.
And then I'm watching CNN the next morning, and up there, you know, it's an innocent question. Question of the week. Should the United States postpone the election in the event of a terrorist attack? Yes or no?
Oh, well, I suppose it sounds like a
how will a normal American that's just interested in watching Fox News, and what will Fox News say about that? Fox News will say, well, it's the only thing that makes sense to postpone the election. Never will the Americans be told that, hey, we held elections during the Civil War, for God's sake, you know? So, I don't know. I hope I'm wrong. I really do hope I'm wrong. But I'd look for that as a possible surprise. And the only other surprise that comes to mind is the Israelis taking out the Iranian nuclear capability, which they would do if we only winked at them and said it was okay. And then we'd have a war president who would be presiding over an international crisis of major proportions, and he would take care of it, no doubt. So what I'm asking is that you sort of be alert to all these things, and tell your friends, to the degree you agree with me or even disagree, let's get people conscious of these developments. Let's make people be aware that for the first time in my 42 years of being really actively engaged in the political process, that there's a sea change, both in the press, you know, and Americans' ability to know what the real story is on things, and that there's a threat to us not only from terrorists, but from our own government in terms of civil liberties. I just came back from Florida, where I was talking last week, and I learned of a Islamic professor who was accused of being a Palestinian terrorist. No evidence at all. The FBI looked into it, didn't find anything, so he kept his job. Then he was fired by the chancellor of the university, and all of a sudden the FBI came up with 17 counts of an indictment against the guy. The guy's in prison. He's been in solitary confinement for 18 years. His wife and his daughter were at my lecture. They asked for my help. So this is what's going on, guys, and I think we need to be aware of it. I wish I could finish on a happier note. Maybe I can. Let's see. Do I have a happier note? No, I think I'll let you ask questions. Thanks very much.